All right, welcome into another episode of That's So Cincinnati. No button today there, Phil. Silent Phil, he's back. Sherry, you're back. I'm back.
You're back from your Thanksgiving nap. I feel like there was a huge nap after the meal you posted on social media. Is that true?
Definitely there was. Hope everyone had a great Thanksgiving. Another packed episode today. Cincinnati Fire Chief Roy Winston is going to join us today to talk about the building collapse last week, the tragedy surrounding that, but the great work that the fire and rescue team did.
And every day.
Absolutely. So really, this is his first time on the podcast, and we're really looking forward to having him in to talk with him. We're gonna stick with what we did last week and we're gonna do a two guest episode today, and it's exciting what's going on to welcome in our first guest from right here in our newsroom, Amber Hunt. What do I call you? I was getting ready to call you our master podcaster.
How about podcast trailblazer?
Podcast pioneer, PP, podcast pioneer. Amber.
That title sticking for you?
Great, thanks.
We'll let Burl know.
Okay.
I see you every day in our neighborhood, and it's good to have you, see you here in the newsroom.
Thank you.
Today we're recording this here on Tuesday. You'll be listening on Wednesday, but this week, today, you launched Accused, season 3 of Accused, the incredible popular podcast that you launched, 3 years ago, right?
Was it? Yep, 2016 was the first season.
Talk to us about Accused season 3 and what all went into that. And sorry, it's an open-ended question, but I'd rather you talk about it than me. I'm shutting up now.
and also, Jason and I are regular listeners, and I'm really looking forward to it, but it did just drop today, and I had to work this morning.
Yes.
So I'm really looking forward to listening to it, but we have not yet. We are just like everybody else, and we have to wait. And I can see that the numbers are ticking up, right? And like a lot of people, like right away this morning, are listening. So yes, tell us, because we haven't listened to it yet.
Well, thank you. It's a really weird season. And I say that, when you're supposed to, I'm not good at the whole marketing thing. You're supposed to come out and say, oh, this is the craziest one yet. No, seriously, this is the craziest one yet.
Yeah.
Because the case happened inside of a uranium processing plant. Some of your listeners surely know Fernald.
Yep.
And a guy went to work one night in 1984 and disappeared. And the police decided at the time that suicide was the only option. And we released episodes 1 and 2 today. Episode 2 is entirely about how we think that's probably not likely.
Wow.
I mean, so much research went into this, right? Like, how long did it take you to choose a topic? And then how long did you work on this? These don't magically... I mean, we all know that. So Cincinnati magically comes just like out of thin air, right, Jason? But this is a lot.
I mean, this is what you're doing is an investigative podcast.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We actually, Amanda Rossman is my reporting partner. She and I had started down two different case paths before we got to this one. One of them was actually a case that the family didn't believe was a suicide, but had been ruled one. We hired a pathologist. Pathologist said, no, I think it's a suicide. And so we set that one aside for now, at least. Another one had a documentary filmmaker following it around. We have limited resources. And then there are, I've actually got an Excel spreadsheet of some 40 cases that are possibilities for around here, because we're trying to keep them at least somewhat local, mm-hmm. just because we can, there's no shortage of local cases. But it's... I forgot what I was saying.
The idea of putting so much work into it. Putting together 8 episodes.
Yeah.
How long did this take you?
This is kind of part of the problem is, so right now I'm super tired because I reached this point and it's like a race.
Yeah.
So we started the research on this in October of 2018. And it's starting to see the world now.
What is his name? I always like to know somebody's name. I think it's important to know someone's memorable, and that's
who they exactly. are. His name's David Box, and actually, there's a little bit known about his case because it was featured in one of the Unsolved Mysteries segments. So there was a 15-minute bit on him. But
that play in perpetuity on cable still. Just as scary. The music is everything.
I know. I still, every time I watch that, I think of my mom because we watched it together every night.
I'd watch it when I was babysitting, and every once in a while I'd call my parents and they're like, "You're babysitting. We can't come there with you."
It's creepy stuff. But and that one is great. If you Google it, you can find it on YouTube. It's complete with cheesy reenactments and all kinds of stuff. But the that got the case out there, but it doesn't. It wasn't a way to dig in, and that's what we were able to do.
Do you have a lot of contact with his family? Are they part of this one?
They are part of this one. The family was important in this one. If the family hadn't been involved in this one, we probably wouldn't have done the case at all.
What jurists are? One more question. Sorry. You could tell, I can't wait. But what jurisdiction was this in?
This was Hamilton County Sheriff's Office. And it looks like, the lead investigator sat down with us. He answered our questions. It does not look like it's a, situation with a sloppy cop or anything. But good cops can be mistaken from time to time. So I think maybe the conclusion was reached a little too swiftly.
I want to back up to 3 years ago, 2016. You had come on here. You came on what, 2014? As an investigative reporter at the Inquirer?
2013.
And then you started working on podcasts. And what went into that, and how did you end up creating Aftermath and finding that first case, which is the cold case in Oxford? How did all that come about?
The cold case in Oxford, the subject of season one of Accused, actually was brought into the newsroom by Jack Greiner. He knew the lawyer who was
attorney
involved.
Attorney with the mostest. He's the Inquirer attorney. And
best First Amendment attorney in America.
All those blacked out records, when you see the answers underneath, thank you, Jack.
Yes, for real. So he brought it in, and it wasn't by any means an assignment or what have you. It's just somebody who is in proximity to a newsroom and thought it was an interesting case, and he brought it to our then editor, Peter Bhatia. And Peter gave it to Amy, and Amy gave it to me just to say, is this worth anything? And at first, we were like, yeah, of course, it's a Sunday story. But then I hooked up with Amanda, who's a visual journalist, and we started recording the interviews, and the audio was really compelling. And then the more we were researching it, the more we realized this didn't get a fair shake. Didn't get a thorough look the first time around. And I asked Peter if we could, and he said yes, and so we did. And that's what we've been doing ever since.
Yeah.
Which is, I'm knocking on wood because it's my dream job.
Did you ever think that this is where your career would go?
No, I couldn't have envisioned this for a couple of reasons. One, somebody told me I had a terrible voice, so that I assumed I wouldn't do well in podcasting. So when the first reviews came back and people actually, some of them like my voice, I was like, score. But beyond that, I've always been a writer. I just write. I mean, poems and short stories, it's always what I've done. But this does feel right. It feels like it's the culmination of, 22 years of journalism, this is what I'm good at.
It's a different way to tell stories. For Jason and I, we're less storytelling and more delivering news. We like to break news on the podcast. And just people want to listen to things now, and we have to change with how everyone else is changing. And I like doing it in different ways.
I love the podcast.
It allows for people's real voices. And when Joe Dieters was on That So Cincinnati, that episode, drew a lot of listeners because I just encourage people to listen for themselves. There's nothing like hearing somebody tell it in their own words, as much as, obviously I can put all the context in and, and have that, but just real words are real words.
Yeah, and the emotion behind them, you know, even 40 years later, it was the case in the first season, it's still raw for all those people, you know. And that's true for this one. The case was in 1984, you know, so we're at 35 years now. And, you know, the oldest son of this guy still pictures this 39-year-old man as his father, you know, and he's now 53. But yeah. that will always be his dad.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it doesn't go away.
What's, maybe I'm getting too in the weeds, but what's the tougher from a process standpoint to record an episode of the podcast or to sit and write that story on your laptop? What's tougher?
Definitely writing it.
Yeah.
I spend more time writing it. We've kind of found a rhythm with the recording. Phil Didion, as your people know.
No, they don't know. They know him as Silent Phil only.
Silent Phil. Okay. So Silent Phil, he's gotten good at, you know, recognizing that I need to be told to slow down or I tripped over something and didn't notice it.
Oh, he speaks to you, huh?
He does.
Wait, we must be perfect.
That's exactly it.
Phil just rolled his eyes.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of finding your voice, and once you do, writing the first episode of each season has been the most daunting of all of them.
So do you then work off of a script? So do you write this out and okay?
Yeah, I do. I write a script. So if you come into my war room,
I look in there, I peek my head in there sometimes, like, this is too intimidating for me to come in there because
it's messy.
There's just stuff everywhere. It's messy. And it's like, man, there's a lot of work being done in here and I'm not going to disrupt.
Well, pretty early in the process, like not so early that I feel that I'm jumping the gun, but early enough that it's helping shape the season, I put on the wall the episodes that I'm envisioning. And I had to change it a couple of times this time. But it's, you know, that way I can sort of see how the story is going to unfold. And, you know, one of the biggest compliments was the editor, Amy Wilson, came in. And in episode 8, she goes, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
because I'm still trying to, you know. Yeah. Pace things.
It's bragging time. How many listeners? How many listeners overall have you had on the podcast through three seasons?
It's a little hard to say because we changed hosts, and that does get in the weeds. But it's my understanding it's between 35 and 40 million.
Dang,
that's our listenership, right? No.
We're like 10 million right now.
I mean, it's just amazing to think. Congratulations.
That's exciting.
Well, thank you. But, you know, what Peter told us is to do good journalism. So that has always been the focus. And that's, you know, I'm sure your focus too here.
Yep.
That's really all we can do is try and do right by the subject and tell the story the best way we can.
Most importantly, in our segment here, where can folks go and listen to Accused, download, listen? Is it free? Tell us all the details about that.
Yeah, we're available all kinds of places. You can go to Apple Podcasts. You can go to Overcast is the one I use on my phone. Spotify. We do have a membership group at Patreon right now where you can get early ad-free episodes. So that's at patreon.com/accused. And that also helps fund the newsroom's internship program.
So then if you want, before the episode is released, if you want it early, you can pay a small fee on Patreon and get it ahead of time.
Yeah, and we also have bonus episodes and an additional podcast that is Amanda and I talking crime together.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's we try to make it worth the $5.
Well, in the previous two seasons, too, we're just like, you want to binge watch. Just like, you know, we're conditioned with Netflix. Like, everything drops at one time. Like, it's like, well, I don't want to stop and wait a week.
Yeah.
Is it go in consecutive weeks?
It will go in consecutive weeks. It gets a little weird again because they being the boss folk are having us take a hiatus at Christmas, but I'm not taking a hiatus on Patreon, so those will keep going.
Gotcha. Amber, thanks. Great work, Amber, Amanda, Rossman. and Silent Phil, and Amy Wilson, your editor, and all the team that has worked on that. Congratulations on your success. Folks, again, find it Accused on most of your list, really all of your listening platforms. It's a great podcast, season 3, and we're looking forward to I guess episode 2 now coming next week, correct?
Actually, 1 and 2 are out today.
Yeah, 1 and 2 are today, and 3 is coming. So we're already in episode 3 next week. Amber, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Let's now jump to Cincinnati Fire Chief Roy Winston. All right, special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast, and it's a pleasure to welcome in Cincinnati Fire Chief Roy Winston. Roy, thanks for coming in.
Oh, sure, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Sherry, I know you got a list of questions.
We've been meaning to have you on. You know, we've had the police chief on, and I feel like, you know, you were one of the unsung heroes last week when we saw the building at 4th and Race collapse, and one of the laborers die with a rescue that lasted more than a day. And last week was a very, very difficult week. And so I just, you know, you'd been in my thoughts and prayers and all of the rescue workers. And I thought this would be a good time really to talk, you know, what it's like, you know, being the fire chief and how much that you all oversee. It's not just, you know, there's a fire here. There's just a lot goes into it. And so welcome to That's So Cincinnati, which, you know, sometimes is serious and not so serious. Serious matter at the moment.
Yes, definitely. Thanks, Sherry, for having me.
I echo what Sherry said, and certainly can't thank you guys enough for what you did last week. I know you really rallied to it, and you don't see that happen often. So what does the department do when it happens?
It is definitely not routine. I think probably about 80% of what we do is medical related, fire being probably other 20%. So this partial collapse, this type of thing is something that is a rarity. I was trying to go back in my head of the last few years. The only other types of collapse I can recall as having is the casino collapse that we had a few years ago that occurred there, as well as the one on 75 near Hopple with that. I think I was on call that night, so I was the one that responded to that for the fire department. But believe it or not, our heavy rescue units, which we have two here in Cincinnati, one that's located just where I'm in headquarters there at 5th and Central, and the other one there on Reading Road out in Paddock Hills, that's something that they train for constantly. Mm-hmm. And so even though it's not routine, that type of search and rescuing, that type of, you know, use of ropes, heavy equipment, things like that, that's something that they train on, they drill on. And so we tease them a lot, give them a lot of teasing because of all, you know, there are technical people, our techies, if you will, in the department. But they definitely perform very well, you know, when called upon in instances like this.
Absolutely perform.
The kind of training you never want to use.
Yeah, true. And maybe you'll train for things in your, you've been in 31 years, you've been with the Cincinnati Fire Department. There might
almost 3 years as chief.
Almost three. Yeah, coming up in April. There may be things you train on that you never actually encounter, which is a good thing, but you still have to train on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And in this case, I mean, our condolences of the department, no doubt, go out to the Delf family.
Yeah.
I mean, that was something that is very unusual in the sense that we're kind of used to, you have an emergency, we come in, you know, we can help to mitigate it, and then we're on our way. Well, in this case, it was labor intensive, you know, and so we became exhausted, we became frustrated, but I appreciate the continued effort of our members. You know, they hung in there, and we started bringing them in shifts, if you will, and then the support. You know, we had a lot of community support with the USAR teams, whether it be from which are the urban search and rescue teams from Hamilton County, Butler County, as well as Columbus. And so they definitely helped to supplement some of our technical people when they became at their limits, if you will.
What is your role now? You know, we're a week out. What becomes the role of the fire department now? They're back to work there. And the investigation still goes on about exactly what happened. We don't have those answers yet, but that's not unusual. What is the role of the fire department now?
One of the things we do, we complete what's called an after-action report. It's an internal report, and what it allows us to do is figure out maybe some lessons learned, you know, where we perform well, but at the same time, maybe we have areas of improvement, you know, and things like that. Because, like you said, that was somewhat atypical, so it doesn't happen every day. But what can we learn from that? You know, communications, the way we manage resources, the way we rehabbed our members. We look at all of that based on the testimony of all the responding companies. Because you think about it, for probably at least the first, I would say probably the first 18 hours or so, you know, 25 to 30% of the department was committed to this event. And so we want their feedback, if you will, based on what they did. And then maybe how we as a command staff can kind of make some improvements the next time if something similar or some large-scale event occurs again.
How does – and this is something you don't hear a lot about. It's not publicly talked about. I'm not sure people in the, you know, the general citizenry really thinks about it. But how when you respond to an event, a fire, a building collapse, and there is a death or a tragedy, how does that affect the department collectively? How does it affect individuals who are you know, this is what you do, you save lives, and you know, how does that impact people?
I would hate to say that you kind of get used to it over time, but yeah. I think to some degree you see it so often that you do get somewhat used to it. But at the same time, I think the feeling probably goes more for the family. Our members, you know, want to help the family get some type of closure. So the faster you can resolve something, at least, you know, the family can have some closure in that regard. So I think our members probably take it a little more personally as it relates to the family and maybe what they're going through and just trying to assist them in that way.
Is it part of your role to communicate with the family if there is a tragedy, and not, you know, not just in the case of last week, but in, you know, if there's a fire and unfortunately if there's a death, is that then part of your role then to communicate with the family, or does someone else handle that? Or
it's my role to make sure it happens. But like yeah. In this case, one of the things we did, we had within our command system, we had one of our assistant chiefs. His job essentially was to try to provide as much communication as he could with the family. The Hyatt was gracious initially of getting them a room, making sure they were fed. So he assisted. The fire department has chaplains. Cincinnati Police has chaplains, so they kind of work together, and he kind of worked with them in coordination with them to make sure the family's needs were taken care of. Now, we had no idea that it was going to go on that long, but he constantly would check in. Even when Mr. Delph was found, he came back in from being off duty to go up with our medical director along with the chaplains to kind of inform the family at that time, just to give them some comfort and at the same time see if there's anything else that's needed. We kind of do that in other high-profile incidences. Normally, that incident commander, whoever's running that incident, may be tasked with that. But if it's a larger scale type of thing where I, as fire chief, have to respond in, that's something we make sure is covered as well.
Yeah. I think before this, like the last major incident was, you know, at Fountain Square with the mass shooting. You know, we saw all of those police officers and their body cams, right? So the police officers really emerged as the heroes. You saw they put the danger before things got even worse. But, you know, what is that like when the fire department, you know, responds? Because you guys were all there first, too.
Yeah, sure. And I tease the police with that all the time as well. But it's a little fun banter between us and them. But in that case, I made a joke. We have ballistic vests, just like the police do. But in that case, I jumped in the vehicle at the Fountain Square with one of my assistant chiefs or operations chief. And so I didn't have my vest, you know. So here I am. We make everybody else wear them. They're walking around with them. I'm the only one that doesn't have it on. So my wife said, make sure I don't do that again. But at the same time, even in that case, I think we were fortunate that we were right down the street. You know, we have a tremendous presence within the core of the city. So we have a lot of fire companies. The police did an outstanding job of mitigating that threat real quickly. And so it allowed us to do what we do. Sometimes I think when it's just happening, you don't necessarily think of all the other dangers that surround or could potentially surround. But in that case, you know, things kind of worked as you would want them to in training. And so we were very fortunate with that, particularly when you look around the country. Not everything goes like that in some of these active shooter situation. So I think we were, you know, extremely fortunate here in Cincinnati with how things went on that day.
Which is so true when you look back, like it was a hard day, but.
Sure.
So you mentioned the ballistic vests, and that's pretty new, right, to the mm-hmm. fire department. I mean, how are things? You've been there a long time, and now as chief, I mean, how much do you have to think about safety these days?
We always say that safety of our members comes first, because if they're not safe, then they can't necessarily do their job. And so to some degree, we have to continue reminding ourselves of that. You know, our union president usually works. He reminds me of it constantly, Matt Alter. But, you know,
that's why we have him.
Yes. But we work well together. And I think because we want to make sure our members can go home to their families, be as safe as possible. And times have just changed. I think, you know, I mentioned I've been on a little over 31 years, but what we did 31 years ago, you know, there wasn't all these safety precautions that we took. Now fire companies stage at violent incidents. We wait for the police to clear the scene as safe as possible, if you will. Back in the day, though, we would just ride in, you know, we'd get there before the police, work on the patient, load them up or whatever, if there was a shooting or what have you. Well, now, you know, our companies are mandated to stage until police clear the scene, and then we come in, and things happen even after they clear it, but yet we try to give our members a measure of safety with the ballistic vest, particularly when you think about what's happened around the country. You know, we're not immune to some of the threats that exist out there, and so our members are on those scenes, and so well, we try to do what we can to make sure that they're safe as well.
In very dangerous situations, because in Cincinnati, I mean, we're paramedics. The ambulances are part of our public safety force, and they are going. I've had the opportunity at times to do ride-alongs, and you're going where the danger is.
Yes, definitely.
How has it been, like, the idea of adapting to the opioid crisis? Because you guys are kind of on the front lines of using the Narcan and, you know, responding to those kind of calls.
I think our members have adapted very well. You know, when you go around to the different firehouses, it's kind of, I wouldn't say it's old hat, but it's something that they're just so accustomed to dealing with. Now, we're fortunate we're not getting the 30 to 40 overdoses a day that we were having, you know, probably back in, I think it was 2017.
It was a couple summers ago.
It was amazing. But now, you know, but they still average probably 10 to 12 every day. But those numbers, wow. You know, are pretty much two-thirds of what they were at one time. So it's honestly something that they've kind of just become accustomed to dealing with. But yet, you know, I appreciate what our members have done. You know, sometimes when you do something repetitively, you can kind of get complacent in it, or maybe not treat it as highly as you should. But I appreciate the fact that our members continue to go out. You know, we average around 250 so calls a day, which, you know, probably approximately 15 might be overdoses of some sort. But yet, you know, they treat each one as they should, as far as that's concerned. So we appreciate them doing that.
Is you know, I know with people, the holiday season, people putting up lights in their houses and all that. Is this the biggest fire risk time of the year? Or is that at a different time or what?
No, it is the most. The fires are up in the wind. They tend to probably start peaking from November through February. Now mm-hmm. our runs are down. Because in the summertime, we make way more medical calls, just mm-hmm. more people in the city, more people out. But yet from fire perspective, yes, they do go up. People are trying to heat their homes one way or yep. another, overloaded electrical outlets, just a whole variety of things. Like you said, lights, you know, the demands are being met. Even some maybe of our homeless population, people trying to get in vacant homes and maybe stay warm. So there's a variety of things that cause us. I know just a couple weeks ago, I think it was like every day, I think there was over a 5-day period, I think we had an extra alarm each day. So it's just kind of par for the course. But the colder the winter is, the more severe that becomes. But so hopefully we'll just pray for a mild winter if we can.
For many reasons, but yes, I agree yes. with that. I mean, winter seemed to come early this year.
Yes.
Does the department do a lot of outreach in the community to try to educate folks on the proper way to light your house for, you know, decorate your house for Christmas? Or do you guys do any kind of, you know, educational outreach, website, you know, stuff like that?
We send out public service announcements. I think we use social media a lot, like everybody else now, whether it be Twitter or Facebook. We try to put that seems to be a nice way to get it out to the community. Our fire company still attend community council meetings each month. So that's part of the, we have a different topic per month. So we're in that season, so they get all that information to share there as well. But another thing we do, we just started, is like a preschool program with Cincinnati Public Schools. And so we go into 13 of our Cincinnati Public Schools. We hope to expand it to the rest of them. Yeah. But we just started back in September. And so the firefighters read a different fire department book to the children, but they also provide safety tips. And so we do that all around the city now. So we're excited about the program, but it's just another way that allows us to, you know, people see us on a bad day, but we try to help them to see us a little bit more, maybe on some of their good days as well.
I love that. The kid, and I bet the kids love it.
Yes. Yeah. It's been great. You know, we have one of our civilian members of the department is taking the lead on it, and she's been great with coordinating all of those events for all the fire companies.
Yeah. Firefighters, men and women, do they go in and bring their equipment in when they speak to the classes and read to the classes?
Yes, you know, because kids love that.
Yeah, so, I know. Yeah.
But other reasons we try to do, not only do you give them tips, but you try to help the children not be scared when a firefighter comes in. You know, we come in with that heavy, you know, equipment, the SCBA, which is our self-contained breathing apparatus that they wear. Sometimes they can be fearful of that. And so one of the reasons why they put it on is just to help them appreciate that they have no reason to be scared if we should happen to come to their home.
This just popped in my mind. I was watching something on YouTube the other night, and it was a 9/11 thing came up, and I don't remember why it came up. But you being in the fire for 31 years, did you notice a difference after 9/11 about how people view firefighters? And was it a noticeable difference? If there was a difference, is that you still see it to this day?
I think there was. I mean, I think it showed us in a different light. I mean, I think as we start off the show, we talked about how we can kind of do some of the basic things. Yeah, you fight fires or you, you know, you do medical runs. But I think after 9/11, our jobs took on a dramatic shift as far as our role in the community was concerned. You know, when it suspicious packages, you know, white powder, all those things we started responding to. So I think the public saw us a little differently. One of the things I will say, though, is I think we as a department maybe didn't deal with that initially so well. And almost like we retreated to some degree. You know, we used to always leave our doors up. We'd sit outside, you know, just shoot the breeze, relax until the call came in. But it was almost like because people were using firefighters' equipment to do other things with it, you know, around the country and around the world, we kind of kept our doors closed. We kind of retreated, if you will. And then we went through the brownouts from 2007 to 2011. I think some of that left a bad taste in some of the firefighters' mouth. So I think one of the things as chief I've been trying to do is have more community engagement. You know, the city takes good care of us. The citizens as a whole take great care of us. And so that's just another way, I think, for, you know, being a part of the community that we can really extend ourselves in that manner.
Well, it's interesting. I was just having my brother's a police officer in another city, and we were just talking about this, like how much, you know, differently you do so much work hand in hand with the police department, but how much differently, certainly, you know, the public views the fire department and the police department. And I'm generalizing, but you know, I think generally that citizens view firefighters as heroes. And I think the police to some extent as well, but certainly the firefighters. When people say that to you, like, you guys are heroes, what do you tell them?
It's kind of an age-old question, right? But I think to some degree, most firefighters will always say, I'm just doing my job. I mean, that's, you know, we tend to be a little more low-key firefighters don't accept rewards or awards very well. So sometimes it's just, I think that's just a personality. Service. It's just a mindset. And I'm glad it's the mindset. But at the same time, we appreciate, you know, that the community does value us. I don't think we want to take that for granted. But at the same time, we don't necessarily need the limelight per se that goes along with that. It's just something we're trained to do. And, you know, we just want to be able to do that.
You know, while we have you, this is, was it last week or a couple weeks ago, a really huge fire broke out at a home in North Avondale, and the firefighters responded and they hooked up their hoses and no water comes out of the fire hydrant. Is that correct?
Well, water came out. It was just low volume. Yeah, the pressure was there, but the volume of water was significantly diminished.
Does that?
It's like Jason's looking at my to-do list on my desk. Oh. Is that a possibility?
Does that happen very often, or is it?
Fortunately, in Cincinnati, we have a different geography here in Cincinnati. I grew up, first of all, in North Avondale, so yeah. I not too far from there is where I grew up. So I do recall, even in years past when I used to work in that community years ago, North Avondale has a lot of older mains. You know, it's an older community.
It's an infrastructure.
Yes.
Thing. Okay.
And so I know the Waterworks has a nice plan. They have 14,000 hydrants around the city, and they have a plan to replace some of these old mains. But just like that, in that case, that was a 6-inch main, but it was 1910, I want to say, is when it was put in. So even that 6 inches is probably through corrosion and buildup, it's not truly 6 inches. And so in that case, we were not able to get a tremendous flow. Now, if we get knocked that fire down with our hand lines, it could support hand lines. But when we went defensive there in that home, it could not supply, you know, our master streams, as we call them.
And hand lines, that's like the water on the truck?
Yes, those are just basic, like 1¾-inch, 2½-inch lines that they lay to go in and fight a fire in the interior. But when we go defensive, we have to use those ladder pipes or master streams that come off of the truck. You'll see them sticking them up, you know, with the ladders. Yeah. They just take a lot more gallons per minute. They probably put out about 1,200 to 1,500 gallons per minute, whereas that hydrant probably was only supplying, you know, a couple hundred gallons. And so the stream could come out. It just really couldn't support.
I mean, it's basically, it's almost like you turn a garden hose on, essentially, right?
Yes.
And that's what happened when the guys hooked up to this fire hydrant. You're trying to put out a massive fire with a garden hose, essentially.
Yes.
A garden hose stream.
And then initially, all three of our companies laid off to hydrants on that same street. Rose Hill is a pretty long street, so they all laid off to those hydrants, which were all tied in on the same main. So initially, all three of them were working, but when they realized they got this deficient water, we had to shut two of them down and only run from one. But even that one really couldn't supply enough water to really put out that fire.
That prompt an inspection. I mean, that's almost, I mean, citizens kind of expect that the fire hydrants, you know, we're taught to respect them, not park in front of them. People expect that that's what they're there for. Does that like prompt some sort of like new inspection program, or just this happened this one time? And
no, I think I've met with the Waterworks, because a lot of times, even though it's their equipment, they don't necessarily know what's going on until we tell them. You know, I mean, we're the ones
because they're not using them.
Exactly. We're the ones that use them. In the spring, we go out and we flow the hydrants just to make sure for our own benefit that they work. But in this case, you're not putting it under any test, any pressure test or what have you. So, you know, a firefighter probably just felt, oh, yeah, this, you know, it comes out. But the volume, you don't crank it all the way up, you know, like you normally would in a fire. And so they had no idea that the volume wasn't there at that time. And so one of the things the Waterworks is doing, but on the fire service, we know where our bad water tends to be oftentimes if we've had incidents. So in our computer-aided dispatch system with our 911 center, we'll put premise histories, as we call them, in that system that notify us of where we have low volume. Using an example down in the Mohawk area, streets, I think Stonewall, some of those streets there, we know we have low water pressure down in that area, low volume. Well, they bring water from other places by way of policy, you know, to just lay longer lines to get water in there. We don't even mess with those hydrants if we have something on that street. But there are plans in place when the Waterworks knows where they have issues, that they just make that a higher priority to try to repair those mains.
And water, like fire, like water does so much. Like they're just, they touch a lot of different functions of the city. It's not just like, oh, the water that comes out of your tap, that's right. Water and you pay your bill. It's so much more than that for them, I know.
Yes. But I think I was talking to Waterworks. I think they, a third of all their mains are 6-inch mains. So some are newer, some are older, but they're kind of looking at that to see maybe trying to reprioritize some of that. And we're going to try to assist them by going out and testing some. We have the manpower, if you will, 900 members of the department. And so we're going to assist them to try to hopefully keep something from that, like that happening again there.
What do you love best about your job?
Let's see. I had more fun, I'll say, when I was a captain, when I was a firefighter. So back in the 90s, I guess I've been sitting behind a desk more administrative since 99 when I became a district chief.
Yeah.
But so I miss all the fun of just running in, if you will. And
that adrenaline rush.
Yes, yeah. Yes. You know, I used to go skiing when I was younger and a little more healthy. And that was a rush. You know, firefighting is kind of like that, you know, when you run in a building. When you're, when you're able to utilize your training like that, I mean, I have good days now, but it's nothing like what I had as a young man. My wife probably appreciates what I do more now, sitting behind a desk, a little safer, you know.
I was going to say that your wife's happy you're not running.
Yes, I've had some injuries, but it's a great job. I mean, I think as growing up, I never envisioned being a firefighter. I think I was thought I was going to go to college like anybody else, or either that or I wanted to play in the NBA somewhere. But that didn't happen. And so family friend told my father about, you know, the fire. He was a firefighter. And so happened to get on, and, you know, but it's been a rewarding career. I mean, you can only imagine how many lives you've touched in one sense or in another. And as I'm winding down, if you, my career in that sense, but I would never have traded it for anything.
How often do you actually go to an event, or is there a certain event, I guess, for lack of a better term, to prompt you to go to the site, or can you just make that judgment call on your own?
My staff, I have 5 assistant chiefs. Right now we're down one through a retirement, so we have 4. But normally those 4 individuals do a great job of taking care of anything after hours, if you will. Since we are short one, I fill in for the one that's missing. So I go to a little more here lately just because I'm filling in when it's my turn. Like this past weekend, I was on call. So I've done a little bit more. But normally, I don't start listening in terms of responding until it becomes like a 2-alarm or some other significant event where the resources will kind of outpace what that incident commander can handle. Mm-hmm. And so just to make sure that there's enough staff, sometimes, you know, usually they want me to stand in front of the camera and talk to the camera. So that's what I end up doing once things kind of settle down a little bit, just to kind of take that off of them. And so, but I got an outstanding staff, so they kind of make my job somewhat easy.
Yeah.
No, I agree. I mean, a lot of communication, like that's a hallmark of our fire department for sure.
Chief Winston, really, really appreciate you doing this. I know it's been a very busy week for you and for the department, and just wanted to thank you for all you do and the Cincinnati Fire Department. And thanks for the great work you do and keeping us safe here in Cincinnati. Thanks.
Oh, thanks, Jason. I listen to podcasts, but this is my first podcast I actually got to participate in, so I appreciate you guys having me.
I feel like you have a whole new career now.
Really, we don't hear from you. Yeah, the fire chief a lot of times, you know, you talk to the police chief, but it's great to be able to just sit down and have you talk about the department and tell your story. And so, thanks again.
All right, thank you.
Thanks again to Chief Winston, Sherry. I really enjoyed our conversation with. That was really, you don't hear much from Chief Winston. Yeah, he just, he's low key.
Quietly runs his department.
Quietly runs his department, and it is a good department. And, but really appreciate him coming in and sharing about that. And sorry, I'm stumbling through this a little bit today. I'm not feeling real well. And so I feel like I'm stumbling over my words, and more so than I usually do, with Amber and Chief Winston. So Bear with me here as we get through this.
It's inappropriate for me to say you don't look that great either. I'm just kidding. I could tell.
That's
that
pretty much every day.
I could tell you're feeling under the weather today.
But I don't feel terrible enough that we can't talk about this next thing. Let's shift gears, talk a little about something fun. Fake or real, Sherry? And I mean Christmas trees. Fake or real Christmas trees. Where are you at on that?
I am a big Christmas person, so I have both.
You have two trees?
I actually have more than two, but the two tree, I have a tree in our family room that is faux, and then we do always get a real tree.
Faux. Every time I think of faux now, I think of the food, like the food faux, right? Oh, pho, sorry. But it's spelled pho, P-H-O. Oh, where are we going with this?
We're word people. You could tell, like, we're reading the words.
Okay. But, so you're both.
We did the great hunt for the real tree.
Are you a politician, by the way? You answered both. You're like, oh, I like both.
Well, I just feel like political. More is more. Jack did panic when I put up the fake tree. He's like, oh, are we not getting a real one? But
attaboy, Jack.
I was like, I got this. And so every year we do something different. The past years, we have made it out to the Rossman Christmas Tree Farm. It's one of my very favorite things to do. Amanda Rossman, our coworker, her family's Christmas Tree Farm.
She oversees the podcast operation.
That's true. It's just
her family owns a Christmas tree farm.
Yes.
Yeah. That's where's it at?
Far away.
It's out
in like Amelia.
Okay, Claremont.
Yeah, but you know what? If you're going to a Christmas tree farm, they're not, you know, plop right next to your house. That's part of the fun.
Yes.
You know, like the long ride, picking out the right one, bringing it back. This year, there's a smaller window of weekends, and we did leave town for Thanksgiving. So we ended up, we went lot to lot looking for the right tree.
Oh, boy.
I'm kind of picky.
And where'd you get it at?
I have to say, I saw really good trees, but the Coolidges have a small living room. And so the problem is more the house and not the trees. I'm a big proponent of the Caracol charity Christmas tree at Finley Market. They bring in lovely trees from North Carolina. They sell at Finley Market online. There's like a Facebook thing where you can like it with all the different days. And,
nice.
You know, we went there and they were a little large for what we needed, but I really wanted to get one of those this year. But
so where did you get your tree at?
So then we went to a Boy Scout lot close to our house. I was confident, same problem. Trees were large and lovely, but I didn't think they would fit. The Target parking lot and eventually Home Depot. But a real tree is a real tree.
Thanks for asking this question. Real or fake? That's a good question, Sherry. I asked the question.
All right, do you have your tree up?
I do not. We had this discussion over the weekend. We've had a fake tree the last 2 years. Our first two Christmases at our house that we now live in. And it was the first time I've ever had a fake tree in my entire life. Now, I grew up in the country. And so our tradition every year was to go out on our farm and find a tree and cut it down. And we've had some Charlie Brown types of trees, limbs just everywhere. And it was always a joke in our family growing up. So then within the past decade, my mom and dad now go out to a Christmas tree farm and cut it down. And so
I love that tradition though. I mean, that's what Christmas is really about. It's not like whether you have a real or a fake tree, but it's like the traditions of your family. I think
correct.
Jack was like thinking in his head, like, are we actually going to go out as a family and have lunch and do that. I don't think he was like at 11. I don't think he was like, oh, is the tree going to be real? I think he was like, are we having that day? Yes. All of us together.
So we had this discussion on Saturday, this past Saturday. And my wife says, do you want to get a real tree this year? I was like, yeah, we'll go out and cut one down. Well, Reed, my 7-year-old here overhears me saying that. And she's like, no, we just get a real, and we go to like Home Depot or Target or Kroger and get one. I'm like, oh yeah. Like, well, we can just tell him. He's like, no, he's 7. He's going to know. Like, you can't fake it now with that.
No, that's
true.
You can
still do that with a 3-year-old.
Kids are smarter than you think they are, as we've learned. And they also have better hearing than you ever think they do.
Oh. So we're getting a real tree this year, which I'm excited about. Returning to the real thing. I can't stand the fake trees. I love the smell.
The house does smell amazing. The car, we put it in the back of the car and it smells amazing. There's needles everywhere, but that's part of it. You know, it just occurred to me, I haven't watered it yet. Probably something I need to do the second I get home tonight.
Yeah, 3 or 4 years ago when we were in our old house, and I went like a week without watering it.
No, you can't do that.
Yeah, not good.
It's a shorter holiday season, so, you know, it's like, it's just a shorter period of like having it. So I did want to do it like right after Thanksgiving.
Yeah. So we've decided you like fake and real, and I like real.
That seems right, actually.
Silent Phil. He's going to signal and say he likes, I think he likes real, don't you, Silent? Yes, Silent likes real. Gives me the thumbs up on that.
When it's, honestly, when it's dark and cold outside, there's nothing better coming home.
Baby, it's festive. Cold outside. Old Navy drawstring pants.
Maybe you don't feel bad. You haven't sung in so long.
I just remember that commercial from like 15 years ago.
Wow. Okay.
What else we got? Sherry, anything else fun for us?
I think that's good. I mean, I did goat yoga last week, so.
How was Youngstown?
It was good. It was good. I told my mom about having Sherrod Brown on the podcast where he suggested maybe I go to visit them more often, and that went over really well with her.
I'm sure it did. He's a beloved figure in that area of the state.
And politics aside, I think she just liked the idea that someone else was telling me to come home besides her.
Well, you know, but Sherrod Brown he transcends the party line. He's just, it's like you feel like you're just talking to like your uncle or a brother, or he's an easy guy to talk to and fun to just chat with.
No, definitely. And so it's a.
Your mom and dad, they like real trees?
Well, and when we were little, we definitely had the real tree. I think maybe the older you get, the more you don't want to mess with the mess.
Yes.
I decorated their house for Christmas. I mean, I love Christmas. I think they're just like, at this point, they know that I'm willing to do it and I like it.
Great.
You putting lights on outside your house?
No.
Alex Coolidge did that for Jack.
Did he?
Yeah.
Also, you're guilting me into it.
Maybe.
Still not going to happen.
No?
My wife tries to guilt me into it every year, and I'm like, I'm just not going to do it. Just put, you know what? Here's what we did. Here's the best way to get around that. Oh, let's put those little candles in the window, and like then that way people know you're in the Christmas spirit.
She knows you better
than
that.
And you put a wreath on your front door. We actually have a family member who sends us as her Christmas gift to us every year a actual live. Like wreath that, I mean, it's made of.
I bought one from a fundraiser. It's coming this week. I can't wait.
So, yeah, we always look forward to that. Jennifer, thank you.
The real guilt that comes in is, you know, two of the neighbors then put up their lights after Alex did it. He chose a nicer afternoon. And so now everyone on the street pretty much has their lights up. But, you know, that's where the guilt comes in. It's like, oh, then everyone's like, well, Alex is doing it. So,
are you a Christmas card person?
Yes. There's no part, you can ask me every question there is about, we can do 20 questions about Christmas. There's no part of me that's going to be like, no.
See, here's this weird thing for me with Christmas cards. Like, we haven't done it, I don't think, since we've been married. That's almost 10 years. My wife just does everything out, and like Bethany just does all this other stuff. And like, and then I'm like, wait, aren't we going to do Christmas cards? Because, you know, so many people send us cards, and then you feel like, wait, like, why aren't we sending these out? We have kids and, well, we had a dog. Rest in peace. But, you know, it's like, we should be doing this.
I mean, part of it is, like, I like seeing, I've lived in several cities before I came to the Inquirer. And so I have friends from all over. And I do love seeing their families and their children.
I do too.
Not everyone, it turns out, is on Facebook. Who knew? And so it is a time to, like, check in with people. I don't tend to write, I mean, if you're heavily on social, I don't like write like, here's my family brag letter. It's like, it is what it is. But I like seeing the pictures, and that's pretty much why we do it.
I do too. I love that too. And then you hang them up. You get a little special. Do you do that?
We do, yes.
So we do that as well. And I'm like, I'm just kind of like, I look at this every winter, every Christmas season. And I'm like, why are we not doing this? People thought of us to send this to us. It's not so much like, I mean, it's great to see people's family. I mean, just it's the thought that people put into it. Like, oh, they thought highly enough of us to send a Christmas card. And it's like, and we're not sending them out. But we love all these people. So I mean, why aren't we sending
work.
Maybe you know what I should take that on this
year. Should we?
Since I do nothing else around the house.
I feel like that's probably not true. Should we send out a Christmas card? It could be love from That's So Cincinnati. All right, I'm putting you in charge of that project.
Talk to Burl. You got your little Burl button? No Burl button, Silent Phil says today. Anyway, are we about done with this?
It is. We can talk about Christmas. Like, there's several episodes. We have some special ones coming up for the holidays planned out because we want you to keep listening, even though it'll be, you know, our time to post stories is, you know, on Wednesdays, Christmas and New Year's. But yeah, we're still here for you.
We got some things planned, yes. And we're definitely, 2020 is a huge year. We're going to have all your political stuff here. Obviously, we're going to have all our columns and stories on Cincinnati.com as well. But in terms of having this platform where we bring folks in for 20 and 30 minute interviews, it's very complimentary to the reporting and the columns that we're writing. And thanks, you know, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I can't thank folks enough for listening. And it's such a big deal, and the feedback that we get. And so thank you again. And Sherry, do you want the last word or no?
No, I'm good. I'm just excited that we're having a Christmas card.
For Silent Phil and Sherry Coolidge, this is Jason Williams saying so long, everybody.